This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. The coronavirus in China is being watched with a wary eye around the globe. The death toll is now 56 in China. Meanwhile, the U.S. consulate in Wuhan, the city at the epicenter, announced it will evacuate its personnel and some private citizens aboard a charter flight. Reuters' Edward Baran has more.
The ability of a new coronavirus to spread is getting stronger, China's National Health Commission said on Sunday, as authorities in the country and around the world scramble to prevent a pandemic. More than 2,000 people have been infected globally, and dozens in China have been killed by the disease. A handful of cases have been reported outside China, including in Thailand, Australia, the United States and France. China says knowledge of the virus is limited and that containment efforts, which have thus far included curbing transportation and travel, and the cancellation of big events would be intensified. The virus is believed to have originated late last year in a seafood market in the central Chinese city of Wuhan that was illegally selling wildlife.
That is Reuters' Edward Baran reporting. Working against the clock, Turkish rescue teams are pulling more survivors from collapsed buildings Sunday, days after a powerful magnitude 6.8 earthquake hit the country's east. AP's Charles de Ledesma has more.
Turkey's health ministry says rescue workers are continuing to search for dozens of people buried under the rubble of collapsed buildings in central Turkey, warning that the death toll is likely to rise. The quake hit Friday evening at a depth of around 4 miles. Monitoring centers gave magnitudes ranging from 6.5 to 6.8. At least five buildings are reported to have been destroyed, while hundreds of other structures damaged and made unsafe. Rescue workers are working round the clock with over 1,000 personnel involved. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And from Washington, you're listening to VOA News. U.S. President Donald Trump's legal team began their defense in the president's Senate impeachment trial this weekend. Sunday on Twitter, Mr. Trump is praising his defense team and criticizing Democrats. On ABC's This Week, Republican Senator James Lankford says the trial shows the House of Representatives failed in its investigation.
Looks like they're asking the Senate to go be special counsel, go search, go seek out. That's not really the task of the Senate. The task of the Senate is to hear the trial. The House is the one that's actually gathering the information for impeachment, so we're acting on what they're sending us.
On the same program, Democratic Senator and presidential candidate Amy Klobuchar tells Republican senators Republican senators face a crucial test in the impeachment trial.
Zero witnesses plus zero evidence equals zero justice. You can't have a trial without the witnesses. However they vote, whatever they choose to do when the evidence comes in, they cannot go down in history as the people that blocked the truth from coming forward, because eventually it will come forward.
Mr. Trump is only the third U.S. president to be impeached and tried before the U.S. Senate. Meanwhile, a video has emerged of a 2018 dinner at which President Trump appears to call for then-Ambassador to Ukraine Marie Yovanovitch to be removed. Reuters' David Doyle has more.
It's April the 30th, 2018, and halfway through a dinner at the Trump Hotel, the U.S. president can be heard appearing to give the order to remove the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch.
Get rid of her. Get her out tomorrow. I don't care. Get her out tomorrow. Take her out. Okay?
A video of the meeting emerged on Saturday and was obtained by Reuters from Joseph Bondi, the attorney for Lev Parnas. He's the former associate of Donald Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani and has been providing evidence to Democrats as a part of the president's impeachment trial in the Senate. Trump has said he had the right to fire Yovanovitch, a main figure in the series of events that led to his impeachment, which he did in May 2019.
That is Reuters' David Doyle reporting. Hundreds of anti-government protesters flooded the streets of Iraq's capital and southern provinces on Sunday, defying a powerful Iraqi religious leader who recently withdrew his support from the popular movement. Security forces fired tear gas and live rounds to disperse the crowds. At least 22 demonstrators were reported wounded by Iraqi security forces. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he hopes to make history during his upcoming trip to the White House for the expected unveiling of President Trump's Mideast peace plan. The plan's release has been repeatedly delayed, and it seems to have little chance of success. The Palestinians have already rejected it, accusing Mr. Trump of being unfairly biased towards Israel. From Washington, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Judgment is allowed to step to honor will damage the democratic process. The little gain that has been made by Nigeria and Nigerians since 1999 when the country went into long years of military.
A former Imo State governor petitions the Nigerian Supreme Court to reverse a ruling removing him from office.
Supreme Court has said not once, not twice, not thrice. And this is the Supreme Court that was put in place by Mr. Museveni. It has said that our elections are rigged, that he intimidated voters, beaten up and brutalized by state security for him to win.
The Ugandan opposition People Power Movement reschedules its consultation program ahead of next year's general election.
That let us respect the judiciary, let us respect what they determine as a person that follows law, as a party that follows and respects the rule of law. And we want to be able to do that so that we are upholding the institutions that have been empowered to deliver justice.
And the Malawian main opposition leader praises the activities of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, which include demanding the ouster of the chairperson of the Electoral Commission. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, Emeka Ehedioha, the former Imo State governor, has petitioned the Nigerian Supreme Court seeking to be returned to office. His lawyer, Emeka Opara, says there is need for the court to reverse the decision which led to the removal of Emeka Ehedioha from office. In its ruling, the court declared Senator Hope Uzondima, the ruling party or Progressive Congress or APC candidate, as governor. The ruling prompted a series of protests in Imo State and other parts of the country. The protesters decried the judgment, saying it was a miscarriage of justice. For more about the petition calling on the court to reverse its decision, I reach Emeka Opara, lawyer for the deposed Imo State governor, Emeka Ehedioha.
We want the Supreme Court to review that particular judgment. There are many grounds. One of them is that that judgment was obtained by fraud. Another thing is that the curious effect is that the number allocated by the Supreme Court to this fourth person, which made him overshoot in number, the third, the second, and eventually the person that came forth, which is the sitting governor, that the numbers allocated to him made it now. The result of the fact is that the number of votes cast at that election superseded the number of the voters that we are rightly accredited to vote in that election by more than 100,000. And that is impossible because under the Electoral Act, it is one person, one vote.
What do you see as the prospect of your case for success?
Yes, there are also some other issues that are coming up. I may not want to say now. But we believe that we have a very strong case. We also know that this particular case has caused a lot of fury, both nationally and internationally, as you are calling me now from outside the country. We know that it will damage voter confidence. It will increase voter apathy. It will damage investor confidence in the country. And it has given out the impression that extra-legal forces determine what happens in Nigerian courts. And that is what we want the Supreme Court to save the legal system from. We want the Supreme Court to save the legal system and the judiciary from what could become, could be properly termed a judicial phase that could happen.
How confident are you that the Supreme Court that ruled in favor of the current governor will reverse its decision to hand it over to your client?
We have that confidence that the Supreme Court is manned by men and women of integrity. And one of the high points of people of integrity is that when a serious mistake that could cause problems to the judicial system is made, that they will find a way to redress it. And of course, there is a rule in the Supreme Court case itself and under the law and under practice under which they could come to review that judgment and do what is right, do the needful. I would believe that what we are going to point out to them, not a matter of presenting more evidence. No, it is not an appeal. It's not appealing again on the judgment system. It is for the Supreme Court to correct and a mistake that can make the its ultimate judgment unworkable. That mistake has made it unworkable, whatever the could be the outcome. And it could hurt the judiciary, and it could also hurt seriously the a lot of different aspects in this of Nigeria as we know it now.
What is the current situation in Imo State, and what has been the reaction of your client following the ruling by the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I will take them one after the other. The people of Imo State are disillusioned. They are not happy. And it is only what the governor did by appealing to them that there is calm, some calm. So it is like the kind of calm you have before an eruption. And that is what we want to prevent. We want the Supreme Court to be the needful and act fast. Because not just in Imo State, it's not just in Imo State. There were demonstrations throughout the week in Imo State and all over the Federation. Even as far as the north, people saw this as the height of injustice. They have begun to see the Supreme Court as being handling blows with certain elements in the executive, in the presidency, to damage what is left of the democracy of Nigeria. This judgment is allowed to set its hand to damage the democratic process. The little gain that has been made by Nigeria and Nigerians since 1999 when the country went into long years of military rule.
Emeka Opara is the lawyer for the deposed Imo State Governor Emeka Ihedioha. He spoke with me from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. Ugandan parliamentarian Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, says his People Power movement is rescheduling his public consultation program as part of his presidential campaign. The decision to reschedule the consultation program followed a meeting with representatives from the Electoral Commission and the police. Meanwhile, Deborah Malak, the outgoing U.S. ambassador to Uganda, says a discussion about a transition is inevitable in Uganda. Joel Senyonyi, spokesperson for the People Power Movement, welcomed the U.S. envoy's statement, saying the country's youth want a change in leadership. He also tells me the group will soon announce the new date of its rescheduled consultations in an effort to wrestle power from the government in the next general election.
We are now going to draw a new schedule for our consultations, and we shall notify the authorities, police, and they'll write back to us. And in case of any concerns, they'll invite us to sit down and agree on how to proceed. So we are finalizing on working on our new schedule, which schedule we shall release very soon, and then we'll hit the ground running.
If the Constitution allows you to operate ahead of the elections, and you have gotten the clearance from both the police and Electoral Commission, then what is the problem here in the consultation, since that is guaranteed in the Ugandan electoral laws?
It is guaranteed, and the Electoral Commission did give us a green light. The challenge has been with police, because our police is very partisan. It is operating at the behest of President Museveni. And Mr. Museveni does not want us to go across the country consulting, interacting with Ugandans. Why? Because he has lost ground, he has lost support, and he knows that once we go and interact with people, the people are waiting for us. And he doesn't want us to do that. So it's a direct order pretty much from him to say, don't allow Bobi Wine and his team to go across the country interacting with Ugandans. That's the challenge there is. But we're giving this one more shot to say, look, we observed the law before, we're going to observe the law again, write to all the authorities, police and all the others, and let's see how it goes.
But did you get any guarantee from both the Electoral Commission and the Ugandan police that this revision of your new strategy to have a consultation with your supporters across the country will not be thwarted or hampered again, as you initially stated?
Well, that was the general feel in the room where we had that meeting. And we are saying, all right, let's give them another chance to see whether there will be people of their word to say that, look, they will follow the law. So we are waiting to see. And that's why we decided, okay, Let's forget about the past. Let's now draw a new schedule. And we are hoping that police will not come out to frustrate our efforts again.
So what are your views about the outgoing United States Ambassador to Uganda, Deborah Malak, saying that a discussion on transitioning the East African nation is inevitable?
Ambassador Malak has been a great friend of Ugandans. Together with her government, they have always fought for the rights of Ugandans and for human rights violations to cease. As our peers, and I know many times our president says the U.S. shouldn't tell us what to do, we know how to run our own affairs. But you see, Uganda, even though it's a sovereign state, is part of the global village, if you like, the international community. And so our peers have got an eye on us. So Uganda cannot do whatever it wants. Mr. Museveni cannot say, I will do what I want. After all, Uganda is a sovereign country. No, that cannot work. Things don't work that way. I mean, as Ugandans, as a country, we are in South Sudan. Why are we there if it's a sovereign country? The U.S. and others do come out to say, for example, stop the human rights violations. Let democracy prevail in this country, okay? And then the question of transition, something that we Ugandans are very concerned about. Mr. Museveni has been in power today, marks 34 years of him having been in power. He has amended the constitution, literally torn it to shreds, bribing members of parliament, and of course beating up others and arresting them such that the constitution can be amended for him to keep in power. We cannot operate this way.
But Joel, this is the case where Ugandans are voting for President Museveni and his ruling National Resistance Movement Party. They have a majority in parliament that afforded them the opportunity to amend the constitution to enable President Museveni to seek additional terms. So if they are voting for him and his ruling party, that means he is popular and Ugandans want him to stay. Don't you think so?
Look, if this whole idea of him staying, you know, because he's popular, if it was a popular idea, because members of parliament went across the country consulting Ugandans about whether or not the constitution should be amended, and Ugandans resoundingly told them not to amend the constitution. They went ahead, that's why Mr. Museveni had to bribe them to do that, because it was not a popular idea. But also, regarding our elections, the Supreme Court has said not once, not twice, not thrice, and this is the Supreme Court that was put in place by Mr. Museveni. It has said that our elections are rigged, that he intimidates voters, beaten up and brutalized by state security for him to win. The Supreme Court has said that three times. It only fell short of saying, let's have another election.
Joel Senyonyi is the spokesperson for the Ugandan Opposition People Power Movement. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. The Malawian main opposition leader says the work of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, or HRDC, a political pressure group, is commendable. The group has been organizing a series of demonstrations demanding the ouster or resignation of Dr. Justice J. Nansa, chairperson for the Electoral Commission. Supporters of the main opposition Malawi Congress Party, or MCP, participate in the protest demanding she steps down. In part two of my interview with the main opposition leader, Lazarus Chakwera says the HRDC is playing an important role in the country's young democracy.
I was grateful for them as they represented Malawians. This is a coalition of several civil rights groups. And so, you know, what they have been doing has been representative of Malawian feeling.
Let me ask you about your message to the people of Malawi as you held a press conference and interacted and answered questions they posed to you. What was your message to them?
No, I just gave the message to the end that everything that we have experienced in the last 8 months or so and the problems that we keep facing even to date, these are birth pangs because Malawi will be reborn as a nation, and therefore people should not lose hope and say that everything is just gloom and doom. This is, as far as I can see, that there is light and there is might, that Malawi can overcome these things and become a better nation as a result.
Have you engaged any members of the international community, including SADC, to help resolve what Malawians say is the tension in the country?
We have always made our case known everywhere, and so United Nations folks are in the country. They've been meeting with various stakeholders and so forth. So as far as we are concerned, we believe that Malawi's future is great, but We cannot have peace with justice.
Some people have called for all political leaders, including yourself, to encourage and educate their supporters not to engage in acts of violence in anticipation of the ruling of the court. What specific message have you been telling your supporters?
I have been very consistent, and I believe I'm the only one that has been so. We haven't heard anything from the top leadership of the other parties, including whoever is supposed to have won the election. So you need to ask them what they've been doing. But precisely this is exactly what I was doing this morning in educating Malawians and in general, and Malay Congress Party members in particular.
What about the performance of the police? Have they been professional? Because I've heard accusation and counter-accusation that the police favor one group against the other. What has been the performance so far?
I am for the rule of law. And some of the things that have happened, I decry and I condemn that because this has not been the best at all. In fact, they are... even as we speak, issues to do with police, excessive use of force, as well as harassment of women and including rape. And that's a good report at all. These things are out there in the public.
Talking about the rule of law, recently there were calls for the Anti-Corruption Bureau to arrest alleged individuals who attempted to bribe the judges who are overseeing the case that you presented to them, challenging the outcome of the election. What do you make of their action, and did you also call for an expedited action for those who are alleged to have committed this act to be prosecuted to the full extent of the law in Malawi?
Since these matters are in court as we speak, I do not want to say anything and to say let's let the court processes take, you know, let them take place, and then let's respect what is going on.
What is your message to the people of Malawi in anticipation of the court's ruling about the case you sent there challenging the outcome of the presidential election?
My message has been consistent ever since we closed giving testimony in court, that let us respect the judiciary, let us respect what they determine as a person that follows law, as a party that follows and respects the rule of law. And we want to be able to do that so that we are upholding the institutions that have been empowered to deliver justice.
Lazarus Chakwera is the presidential candidate for the Malawi Congress Party, MCP. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. The anniversary of the Egyptians' January 25 revolution, which swept veteran Egyptian leader Hosni Mubarak from power in 2011, is being observed in a fairly low-key manner, as most Egyptians were given that day off, and the government celebrated the role of the country's police in maintaining order. For VOA, Edward Uranian reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Islamist opponents of the Egyptian government had harsh words for President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in social media and on TV channels originating from Qatar and Turkey, which support them. But in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, and most of the rest of the country, there were no significant protests, and most people stayed home after being given the day off. Cairo's iconic Tahrir Square, where most of the major protests against former President Hosni Mubarak took place in 2011, remained eerily quiet, except for some light traffic, and police were on heightened alert along the major arteries leading into the city center. A number of government-organized events took place to mark the event, including one at Cairo Stadium with music to entertain the crowd. Egyptian TV played music to honor the country's police, and President Sisi attended a number of events in recent days to hand out awards and personally thank top officers and commanders. The day originally marked the anniversary of a police insurrection in Ismailia in 1952, which was seminal in the country's first revolution that overthrew King Farouk. Well-known political sociologist Saeed Sadiq tells VOA that the 2011 revolution left a mark on the country in many ways, despite the fact some analysts outside the country have negative words for the ultimate outcome.
We have to remember that revolutions do not produce immediate results. It takes time. We have some results, and maybe we'll get more. For example, for the first time, Egypt began to talk about reforming the education system, reforming religious discourse. This never happened before. So a lot of taboo topics began to be raised.
Sadiq also notes that both women and Copts who were previously marginalized began to play a major role in politics after the revolution due to their first-hand encounter with repression and violence under the Islamists who ruled the country from 2012 to 2013. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that Egypt's unhappy period of Islamist rule put a damper on efforts to democratize the country.
The grand problem of this revolution Egyptian.
He says the big problem with the Egyptian revolution is that it wasn't carried out by democratic forces that would have been able to effect veritable transformations. The attempt to replace a military system of government, he argues, with a totalitarian Islamist regime was a trap that ultimately destroyed the revolution. Abu Diab notes the Egyptian revolution was a historic phenomenon given the massive mobilization of crowds in a peaceful manner, and that there have always been conflicts between military forces and Islamists in the Arab world, which clouds the horizon and makes democratization a difficult process. Given the recent wave of protest movements, Abu Diab insists he sees some reason for optimism in Iraq and Lebanon with efforts to create a national discourse, but that the process is mired in regional and international rivalries between Iran, the U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The United Nations is condemning the deadly attack on a village in the disputed oil-rich area of Abyei between Sudan and South Sudan. It is calling for calm in the wake of the attack by armed gunmen, which left dozens dead and scores injured. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Armed gunmen reportedly killed 32 people, injured 25, and went on a rampage, burning homes and causing other devastation in the Dinka village of Kolom. Spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination for Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, tells VOA the attack on Kolom, about 9 kilometers northwest of the town of Abyei, which straddles both sides of the Sudan-South Sudan border, sent people fleeing for their lives. He says the village reportedly has been emptied of its inhabitants.
I cannot say for sure who instigated the attack. We were not there to witness what happened. We know it is it's a Dinka village and that people have left. But we have assessed since the attack that some 500 people are now in Abyei town, where they are sheltering, I believe, in some schools there.
In the aftermath of the attack, the UN Interim Security Force in Abyei issued a statement saying suspected nomadic Misriya herders from Sudan attacked Kolom. This is the latest clash between the Arab Misriya tribe to the north of the border and the Ngok Dinka to the south since November. This oil-rich region has been in dispute since South Sudan gained its independence from Sudan in 2011. Laerke says humanitarian organizations on the ground are providing health care, including emergency surgical operations, to the survivors of the attack.
OCHA is coordinating humanitarian responses in Abyei, and we are working to dispatch an interagency needs assessment team to the area shortly. The continued intercommunal tensions, population movements, including during last year's flooding, And the absence of public institutions and services have resulted in high humanitarian and recovery needs.
Layerke says the UN and humanitarian organizations aim to provide aid to 200,000 people in the Abyei area this year. Priority needs include health, nutrition, food and water, as well as protection for people at risk of sexual and gender-based violence and protection for children. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs and Music from our African collection. But first, the Food and Agriculture Organization is warning that desert locust swarms in Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia, already unprecedented in their size and destructive potential, could swell exponentially. The agency warns it will increase food insecurity in a region already battered by drought and then floods. Keith Cressman is the FAO Senior Locust Forecasting Officer. He's in Nairobi now as part of the team working to track and stop the swarms. He spoke with viewers Kate Pound-Dawson about the ramifications of the massive swarms and the efforts to stop them.
What we're seeing now is really three areas of very important locust developments. And probably what you've heard the most is the Horn of Africa. And I'll go into that in just a second. But the other two areas that we're watching very closely is in southern Iran and on both sides of the Red Sea. The third one is the Horn of Africa, where I am now. And that by far is the most significant and the most dangerous of these three, hot spots at the moment of desert locusts. I say that because for the Horn of Africa, it's by far the worst situation of desert locusts that they've had to face in a quarter of a century, particularly in Ethiopia and Somalia, and in Kenya for more than 70 years. There are very large swarms that are present in the three countries, and a high number of them. So this is a very dangerous combination, and a very strong, potentially threatening situation to food security, so to agricultural production, to pastures that are very important for grazing animals and for people's livelihoods in the Horn of Africa. Is already extremely vulnerable, of course, to any disruption to their production systems. And, you know, they've faced a series of droughts. Now they've had recently heavy rains and floods. So it's already a very precarious situation without the desert locusts.
You are involved, or you lead the effort to forecast where these swarms are going. What's that outlook?
In the next couple of weeks, or until probably sometime in February, there will still be swarms invading northern Kenya, coming from Ethiopia, from eastern Ethiopia, and adjacent areas of Somalia. And these swarms are coming into northern Kenya, and then they're spreading in Kenya, mainly in the central, and moving towards the west of the country, towards the Rift Valley and towards then the northern parts of the country, which are a bit drier, which is really what the desert locust like, and, you know, as their name implies. There is certainly a threat to adjacent areas of eastern Uganda and to the southeast corner of southern Sudan. And this is very important because both of these countries, the last time they faced desert locust swarms was in 1961, almost 60 years ago, which means that they have virtually no expertise in this matter.
What mitigation efforts can be put in place now, both in countries where we are seeing swarms and in countries where there are concerns swarms will move to?
Those countries that are currently infested, so this is mainly Kenya and Ethiopia and Somalia, control operations both on the ground and in the air are in progress in Kenya and in Ethiopia. In Somalia, it's much more challenging because of the security issues there and the infrastructure. But at least in those areas that can be accessed in Ethiopia and Kenya, the two main countries, these efforts now are being very rapidly upscaled. So they have been, in Ethiopia, the efforts have been underway since the summer, in Kenya for almost a month now. But so far, that hasn't been enough. So there's a great need to upscale the number of teams on the ground, the number of aircraft in the air to treat the current swarms.
Keith Cressman is the FAO's Senior Locust Forecasting Officer. He spoke with viewers Kate Pound-Dawson from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In African football, holders Esperance of Tunisia drew 2-2 with Raja Casablanca of Morocco on Saturday as both clubs booked their places in the quarterfinals of the African Champions League. That result ended the faint hopes of Group D's Chasing Park, despite AS Vita Club's 4-1 win over Algeria's JS Kabylie in DR Congo. Egyptian club Zamalek, who drew 0-0 with already qualified TP Mazembe of DR Congo on Friday, had their qualification to the knockout phase confirmed after Zambia's Zesco United drew 1-1 with Premier de Agosto of Angola in the other Group A game on Saturday. In Group H, Al Hilal Omdurman of Sudan beat Platinum 1-0 in Zimbabwe thanks to a goal from Mohamed Aldai. Al Hilal are now level with group leaders Etoile Sahel of Tunisia. Egypt's Al Ahly are a further 2 points adrift in third. Wydad Casablanca's 3-1 win over Algeria's USM Alger on Friday night was enough for them to qualify from Group C, along with South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns, who drew 2-2 with Petro Atletico on Saturday in Angola. Meanwhile, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has invited Libya to take part in the upcoming African Nations Championship CHAN finals in Cameroon. CAF are looking for a team to replace Tunisia, who have withdrawn from the tournament for locally based players because clubs were reluctant to release their players. Tunisia beat 2014 CHAN champions Libya 3-1 on aggregate to clinch a place in the finals that are due to kick off in April. And in athletics, at the Standard Chartered Dubai Marathon, a World Athletics Gold Label Road Race on Friday, Ethiopian Wokanesh Degefa won the women's race in 2 hours, 19 minutes and 38 seconds. In the men's race, debutants Solika Aduna of Ethiopia and Eric Kiptanui of Kenya carried the day, outwitting the tried and tested marathoners to finish first and second. In the men's race, Degefa won by half a minute from compatriot Getuna Shon, with another Ethiopian Bedatu Harper further back in third. In the men's race, Beshar Yassi ran 206.34, which would have been a world record 2 decades ago, yet his 11th place meant he got zero prize money. The mass sprint was more reminiscent of a track event. The experienced marathoners were keeping a close eye on one another and ignoring Aduna and Kiptanui, but when it came down to speed rather than staying power, Aduna followed the initial sprint of Kiptanui from 500 meters out, then whizzed past him after another 100 meters and took the victory and the $100,000 first prize. Two more Ethiopians followed, with Sadat Abeje getting the nod over Lencho Tesfai. Degefa won this race on her own debut in 2017 and finished fourth the following year. Meanwhile, the Boston Athletic Association has announced the elite international fields for the Boston Marathon on April 20th. Led by defending champion and Ethiopian record holder Wakanesh Degefa, the women's field contains 12 athletes with personal bests faster than 2 hours 23 minutes and 5 runners with sub 220 bests. She'll face 4 other past winners of the Boston Marathon: USA's 2018 champion Desire Linden, 2-time world champion Edna Kiplagat of Kenya, 2015 victor
Caroline Rotich, and Ethiopia's Buzenesh Deba, who set the course record in 2014. Challengers for the title include 2015 world champion and Olympic bronze medalist Mary Dibaba, 2017 world champion Rose Chelem of Bahrain, and 2015 world 10,000 meters silver medalist Gelete Buka of Ethiopia. Four-time New York and London winner Mary Keitany had accepted an invitation to run in Boston, but she's currently sidelined with a back injury. And with 10 men holding personal best times inside 2 hours 7 minutes and most having competed against each other in championship events, the race up front should prove competitive on the challenging Boston course. Defending champion Lawrence Cherono, who also won in Chicago last year, will face three other past Boston champions: two-time winner and world champion Lelisa Desisa, 2018 victor Yuku Kawuchi of Japan, and 2017 world champion Geoffrey Kirui. Uganda's 2012 Olympic champion and 2013 world champion Stephen Kiprotich will make his Boston Marathon debut. Albert Coril, the runner-up in New York last year, and Dejene Dibela, runner-up to Chirono by 1 second in Chicago, will be chasing their first World Marathon Majors victory. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. Link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. In the current petition trial in the United States Senate, and before that, in the proceedings in the House of Representatives that led to the impeachment of President Donald John Trump, the civil servants were giving exceedingly high marks. They demonstrated in their appearance before the House of Representatives their high professionalism, their dedication, their commitment to the Constitution, and their impartiality. This became important because the executive was not prepared to provide documents or witness to the House of Representatives. So the American people came to realize the importance of a competent, impartial civil service. Few years ago, the British House of Lords issued a report on the British foreign policy in the Middle East. It was a critical report, and it stated that the failure of the British policy in the Middle East was due to the fact that less and less reliance was being placed on the British civil servants, and they felt that they should listen more to them. This is a very interesting turn of events, because the British civil service was highly regarded over the centuries. The British themselves learned a lot about an independent and competent civil service from ancient China, where the civil service was developed by the emperors and where a rigorous entrance examination was required to enter the civil service. Anthony Trollope, in his The Three Clerks, demonstrated the evolution of the civil service. And it is also true that the British government, to govern the jewel in the crown, India, had to develop an exceedingly competent civil service in India. The Indian civil service was the pride of the Indian people and government. And it's true to say that the British government in the colonial period did develop competent civil servants. That is the only way they could have been able to govern their vast empire. And when they handed over the colonies to independent African governments, they left behind highly competent civil service. But after the end of the Second World War, something happened to affect the civil service. In the first instance, politicians began to see politics as a profession, and this changed things. And there became a clash between politicians and civil servants. A few years ago, the BBC ran a series, satirical series, called Yes, Minister. And that shows you the emerging conflict. And the way the politicians handled it was initially to create around themselves a non-civil servant staff that would give them what they want. Later on, they began to politicize the civil service. This became extremely bad in Africa. In Africa, the competent civil servants were pushed aside, and politicians brought their own people, their own party members to the civil service, and that became a very serious obstacle to good governance. In fact, there is a high correlation between a politicized civil service and maladministration. And it became so bad that the politicians were now blaming the civil servants for corruption. So what should happen now? It is now clear for all to see that no country can govern well until it has a highly competent, impartial civil service, men and women of integrity who will serve their nation and not the party in power. So African governments must learn from what they see around the world and begin, if they have not yet done so, to do a thorough review of their civil service, to see that they have independent civil service commissions, to see that they have strong, proper examination for entry into the civil service. Because if this is done, those Africans who have qualified from the universities can easily compete in the examination. They don't have to become to be a party member to be in the civil service. So this is the lesson that we are learning. Because Americans today will tell you, yes, we didn't know that these civil servants were so competent. And Africans in the 60s could have said that of the civil service. So politicians must know that it is in their own interest to ensure that they have highly competent civil servants to help them run the government. Because parties come and go. Ministers come and go. You need someone is institutional memory. And they may tell ministers, Mr. Minister, you could not do this or that because it's contrary to the national interest. They should listen. And please remember this. It is a wise person to learn from his or her experience. It is a wiser person to learn from the experience of others. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. You're hearing from Tenny with Billionaire. Eddie Kenzo featuring Pato Ranki will follow with Royal. And then Yemi Alade with Oga.
I wanna be a billionaire. Royal.
Soul Surayako. That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nelson Lopez, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, no matter how full the river, it still wants to grow. I'm your host, Peter Clotet in Washington. Good evening, Africa.